Our next guest, Tracker Dan, lifelong survivalist, tracker, legendary knife maker, Navy SEAL, friend, and above all else, brother. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Hatchets, axes, kind of being revitalized or kind of brought back, I guess. There was a weird period in the early war on terrorism, I guess, where members of the U.S. Navy started carrying around hatchets again.
Yeah.
And when I say again, I mean hatchets. Vietnam had the Lagana, Tomahawk that was used out there, and I think most American wars, at some point, somebody was probably carrying around a Tomahawk, you know?
Yeah.
A very American thing.
Well, and you look at, you know, Rogers, Rangers, their general orders, it's like, keep your Tomahawk razor sharp. And
yeah, so it's a very American thing. I think that's probably your katana, you know. It's a very American specific thing. The native aspect of it, the native cultures that utilize it, and how it was adapted by some of your warfighters into their kind of combined skill sets as Americans, you know, as a new burgeoning country. It's pretty interesting kind of to see.
Yeah.
But at some point during the 2000s, we were sent to Coronado through an invitation by the Department of the Navy, and we had some people there that were NCIS people showing us some things, some Marine corpsmen showing us some medical management stuff, and some SEAL dudes that we were basically foreign nationals, Mexicans, being invited to partake in some training. So we weren't allowed to have phones, take pictures, ask questions, or do any of this type of stuff. So it's like a mystery who some of these people were to this day to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're probably out there somewhere. So reach out if this sounds familiar. But I went out there twice. And one of those times I saw somebody carrying around a hatchet underneath their arm and a kit. They were basically showing us how they would carry their stuff, mm-hmm. How they would load out. You know, they wouldn't let us touch their nods or show us anything about nods because of ITARs, I guess. But like generally how they would lay out their kit, you know, why they would keep their chest clear, with the orientation of their mags, the rounds up or down, the ways they would modify their plate carrier, ways they would carry stuff on battle belts, or how they would kind of unload some of the stuff to their hips, stuff that we didn't know. We were basically winging it as we went. But one of the things that caught my eye was hatchets. Like, what's that for? And I remember them looking at each other and smiling. It's like, for a lot of things, you know?
Yeah.
That led me, got me in contact with Daniel Winkler.
Yeah.
Who is an amazing and legendary knife maker and survivalist as well. He was one of the advisors for the Last of the Mohicans movie.
Well, he made all those period piece blades and right.
Yeah, so yeah. He's amazing wealth of knowledge in this man's arsenal. And I remember getting in contact with him and buying some of those first Tomahawks. He started basically making for members of the military. Some of them prototypes. Like, I remember getting some prototypes because I was getting a lot of use with them, not on people. Cutting irrigation hoses in clandestine grow ops in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Cutting the tail section off a Cessna plane that we couldn't take out of a place that we found it in. Brandishing it to people that have been accustomed for years to be pointed at with rifles and guns. But when that thing comes out, they would kind of freak out a bit. There's a picture of me standing in front of a federal police helicopter with one of those Winkler hatchets underneath my arm. They're cool. Amazing. I think they came back in popularity. I think they showed up on a on a new show, I think, or something like that. So they kind of got revival, and a lot of books have been written where people are carrying those. But I have a picture of me like back in the early 2000s with one of them underneath my arm outside of a helicopter.
Yeah.
They're cool and everything, and like, God bless Dan Winkler. But they're heavy, though.
Yeah.
And although, despite the fact that I'm standing in front of this helicopter, not a lot of helicopters would fly us places or to go get us. It was a lot of walking, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot of hiking, a lot of going into places, a lot of having vehicles not functional, and you had to carry your shit. And that Tomahawk was very heavy. And with the rest of the things that I had going on, I had to lighten up.
Yeah.
So I remember just having going through this research process of like, I wonder what's out there as far as just a better option.
Yeah.
And I run across this video of you doing fast rope out of a tree, I guess.
Yeah.
With a version of this.
Yeah.
Strapped to the middle of a plate carrier.
Yeah.
Right here.
Yeah.
And you were explaining, you know, what went into it, the size, the weight, the sheathing system, and all of these things. But, and I'm like, I kind of want one of those. So I remember reaching out through email.
Yeah.
And just starting a conversation with you.
Yeah.
And you downloaded probably 70% of my current knowledge base as far as like what you should look for in a blade and carry systems and stuff like that, and just this interaction through email.
Yeah.
This is before you had a line out the door as far as people trying to buy your things. For people that don't know this about you, you'll go to a knife show with, again, each of your blades is 7 hours, 8 hours, maybe a bit more on each of them.
Yeah.
So
depending on grind and...
So it's very hard for you to make one of them. And when you go to a show, I mean, they're gone.
Yeah.
People are fighting for a position. You have to do knife lotteries, and they're very sought after to this day. I mean, they're legendary in their own right. Back then, you didn't have that big of a crowd. I remember seeing your work in very special places. Some top-tier people that I would go and interact with or train with would pull out like a blood shark, and I was like, man, I gotta want one of those. They were unobtainable because the person that made them was a mystery. Mm. The internet was a thing, but realistically, it was hard to...
Yeah.
It wasn't like now that you could just look up a YouTube video or go on Instagram. There was nothing like that. It was just forums and people posting them on blade forums, I remember, was one of the places where I saw your work for the first time.
Yeah.
And it was a mystery, though. Like, who's making these? Can you tell us a little bit about the history of, specifically, this guy?
Yeah. So, the knife Scientology cult I was a part of, you know, like you were mentioning, people don't always understand weight and how much you can effectively carry with all the gear that you need. So you got your primary stuff like, hey, sniper rifle's heavy because it's got to be stable. So you carry the weight because it's going to make you have a better shot. But a tertiary type weapon that you may use once in a while, you know, you don't need a dive weight. You know, you can carry more bullets if you make all your, even your packs, you know, like they got all these extra metal tabs and zippers you don't need and tags.
They add up.
Yes, it all adds up. And you cut as much weight as you can so you can carry more bullets or whatever.
More water.
Or
food.
Yeah, or intel gathering camera equipment, you know, that kind of stuff.
Also the fact that you will go in there at a certain weight, but you might find something there and you go out at there at a different weight. Side exploitation is a thing.
Yeah.
Like I remember having to come out of this house carrying around these like four computer towers, like the old school ones.
Yeah.
And like all of a sudden you're like, let's see what I'm going to dump, I guess.
Yeah, and that's one reason why people were, you know, all the military branches back in the day, they'd chop off their solid handles and wrap just them with paracord.
Just to make it lighter, tighter, you know? And also tighter against the body, just less snag points.
Yep.
So you're working at this time, and you're getting to make some of these things for people that are actually going down range with them.
Yeah. So in 2006, I transferred to the active reserves, and that gave me more time to take all the knowledge I had gained from experience to actually make what I wanted to carry in those situations, whether it be, you know, out in the woods for survival or clandestine or tactical. And so, you know, the popularity of Winkler's Hawks with the tier one guys, I was, you know, part of the Knife Scientology group, and they made some serious dive weights. We're talking huge, thick, you know, and people don't understand lugging this thing around. Like, they're used to drive around in vehicles, but when you got a pack on with all your gear and provisions and then all your mags and your weapon and all that kind of stuff, you add fucking big dive weight. I mean,
you're gonna feel it in your discs.
Yes, yes. So, and you know, there's a lot that you see with, you know, huge, heavy, traditional style kukris going through tatami mats. Like, they go through a relatively thin one, and then you get a lightweight kukri that's thin, and you can get it moving faster, and it's thin, there's less resistance, and you can stop it easier once it's through, and it goes through a huge tatami rolled up mat, you know. Like, so I'm not saying a heavy axe isn't great at sometimes, like when you're trying to chop down a tree for making a log cabin or something, but you know, in most cases, extra weight's not always a benefit. Yeah. So
your mindset is now, well, let's figure out more on steel geometry, edge geometry, and minimalism.
Yeah.
Let's go more that route is what you were basically coming up with.
It's always been that way for me personally. But, you know, and I've got to dance around some of this stuff as far as not throwing anybody under the bus from the tier one type people. But so the Knife Scientology people came out with, and you know, I drank the Kool-Aid for a good 12 years. You know, I don't blame anybody for drinking the Kool-Aid, because I've been there. But you know, like, once you know, once you've been married to the mob and you escape, you know better, and you know, you don't want to go down that route anymore. But they had a huge kind of pre-version of this, you know, as far as from point to point, just and then from top to bottom beard wise and then handle length and thickness. And some of the tier one guys were carrying these over in Afghanistan, and you know, they came back and were like, the guy sketched out this shape right here.
And somebody that had
carried it,
previous
versions, tier one guy, and you know, he wanted it thinner, lighter, all that, you know. And I'd made the carry system for that heavier one that he was carrying, and so this Knife Scientology group had just come out with a collaborative spiked hawk that was going to be their big push towards tier one guys, and they just come out with it, and he came back and said, no, this is what I want, this head shape. And you know, you could just hear a pin drop in the room, and you know, the politics took over, and nobody was gonna do anything with this feedback from the field, you know. And I'm like, can I? Yeah, whatever you want, or go ahead, you know. And so I took that head shape and designed the handle I would want for retention and for getting out of stuff and for being able to retain once you go through stuff. Because so many handles out there, they're lacking, like machetes, all that kind of stuff. Like they come just flying out of your hand if your hands are wet, sweaty.
Yeah, when I ordered that from you, I said my main issue was like, make it really grippy, because yeah. I know that, you know, you lose shit in your hands.
Yeah,
when it's flinging around, when you're wet and all that. So you basically took all that gold feedback, how to make something better and more functional that was not being utilized by anybody else.
Yeah,
and you turned it into the legendary Gray Matter.
Yeah.
What's up with that name, though?
Because, you know, yeah. unless you see Gray Matter, they could still be a threat.
Yeah, I don't.
So, you know, security rounds or save your bullets and you which know, again, use the Gray Matter.
Yeah. This is something that is coming back to you as far as people carrying these things as experience. So you're mm-hmm. putting all that into this creation, this Gray Matter. When you come back and you're making these now, you're selling it to members of people that are going downrange, basically, mostly. Like the people that are actually that know. I mean, I'm one that knew about them, but I didn't know about these from knife magazines or people that were not carrying. Like I saw these in the hands of people that were coming back from shit.
Yeah.
With experiences, and they were like, yeah, this is a pretty good thing to have for this and this, vehicle sabotage, tire puncturing, door breaching, like a bunch of different things you can use this for. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that's actually functional, you know?
Yeah. And the big issue with tomahawks is, you know, if it has a round handle, you've got this blade that's leading. So it's a leverage against your grip. So, you know, you got to have oval or flat handles, you know, so it doesn't spin on you. And so many tomahawks, their profile, it provides a rounded surface area that, yeah, it can bludgeon and crush things, but it's not going to penetrate very well. So this front spike, and this is loosely designed on, you know, Morrow Headhunter axes, loosely designed, because the shape on those was crazy. But like you pulled out a picture from Kroll where they had an axe just like this.
Yeah, it was like it was on somebody was putting that online, that like the head shape was like a Kroll piece. And
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the history of where it came from. Like you've been educating me on some of this type of stuff.
Yeah,
but it's a unique shape, you know,
it keeps you from getting glancing bolt blows off the skull, and anything that gets trapped in there gets cut, ripped, whatever. It's not going to glide over the top of the tomahawk.
It's like a fang on there, like a processing fang. So when it goes in, it'll dig in,
yeah.
And it won't glance off with a rounded surface or the flat surface of a blade.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the law enforcement guys who buy stuff from me, they convince me to make a shorter version so they can have it in their little go bag in their vehicles. And, yeah. But, you know, for breaching, because, like, the first Hawk I carried was a C-130 crash axe. And I made a carry system for it and had it on the front plate here. So, because I wanted my deployment to be my attack. Because a lot of tomahawk stuff, you got to get it out and then adjust your grip and all that. But yeah, the breaching potential of these, and you know, I got to live vicariously through you.
Yeah,
on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, we got to use those a lot.
Yeah.
I remember just carrying mine, and I remember the questions I would get. You know.
Yeah,
I would walk around with this thing on my strap to my, and it, you know, when something would get in the way, you know, some people would carry around a crowbar. I would carry that thing, you know?
Yeah. So
everything from meal prepping to doors and car hoods and trying to figure out if there was like a car with cocaine in the internal chassis of the car. And
yeah,
people were looking around for things to cut that off. Like, get out of the way, can opener.
Yeah.
It's an interesting tool. And I remember it definitely had like an effect on people when you,
yeah,
you pull that thing out, which yeah, is, you know, I remember reaching out to you about it, to get one and just carrying it. And I would, you know, send you, you was at like, if you have any feedback, just send it to me. It's like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I started sending you some of the feedback that I would get just from just carrying something like that. And also just your knives, like a blood shark, that I remember ordering from you with a top edge sharpened on it.
Yeah.
You know, just as an emergency thing.
Which is now the Ed's Edge.
It's such a, I mean, I learned that from my mom. Basically, always have a top edge that you use for emergencies only.
Yeah.
It's nothing ninja about it. It's my mom is a ninja. I'm just a poser, you know? We have this interaction around blades. And then just advice, general advice for training and stuff like that. I remember we had some conversations about that. And we developed a friendship.
Yeah.
Pretty cool friendship. I remember going out to see you. I think you were going through training or something like that in Coronado. It's the first time we met each other,
yeah,
like in person.
Yeah. Probably at the Burger Lounge.
Yeah. And I went there and I hadn't put two and two together. But I met your wife, Kelly.
Yeah.
Who is famous in her own right.
Yeah. Guess. Yeah.
It's like, hey, wait a minute. Like, you're Dan. I know you, Tracker Dan. Like, I know you from somewhere. Where do I know you from? And I was like, Nip Tuck.
Yep.
It's Kimber from Nip Tuck.
Yeah.
She's pretty cool. A cool lady, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, getting to meet both of you and just seeing like, oh, okay. So this, I get it now. This lifestyle that you have for yourself where you're trying to basically do this, be attached to the Navy and do that as well, and pursue more of your teaching aspect of basically turning some of those lessons into like lessons for others.
Yeah.
I got a sense of that with you two guys there, because when I went and saw you the first time, all you had for me was advice. And a lot of that advice was like, don't do that forever. Whatever job you're doing down there. And you were, Kelly and you were trying to orientate me into like ways of not staying at that job that I had. So I remember just having this feeling of like, these guys are not only fucking cool and they know a lot, but they're also like, you know, they have that, my best interest in mind as far as like not staying at this job.
Yeah,
it was unacceptable to me in my mind that I was not going to be doing that.
Yeah,
because that's all I knew how to do.
Yeah,
becomes
your identity.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I remember speaking to you throughout this. I think it was like I got to meet you a few years before I had to make this decision, and I was already kind of trying to figure out my place as an instructor and. We collaborated on knife design, I remember, and that was like successful, and I couldn't figure out what that meant, you know? I come to a point in my life where I have to make decisions, and I remember one of the first people that I called was you.
Yeah.
I remember calling and say, Dan, I said, remember you offered to help me out if I ever have to fucking, you know, burn the boats?
Yeah.
And in a very calm and soft voice, he said, yeah, is it time? I said, yeah, I think it's almost time, Dan. I had a very hard time transferring back into operational work. So I spent some time doing close protection work for a governor in Baja. And then after that was over, I went back to the streets, basically doing operations work again.
Yeah.
Being a high profile, very visible face next to the governor.
Yeah.
To going back into the dark.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way, but that's basically where they sent me.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, I think they sent me there as a way to end me, I guess. But I went back into that job. I went back into working. I remember saying, hey, Dan, like, bring this thing out of retirement, just putting it back on my vest, and I would send you some pictures of me out there working.
Yeah.
But things were, like, really dark. And the support we used to have was gone. Leadership was abandoning ship, and it was just unsustainable, and it had to.
Yeah.
I was approached with a very serious offer of working for one side or another, and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And I remember just having this phone conversation with you, and you're like saying, hey, I need to run. And you said, come hide.
Yeah. We got you.
This, my American experience was very much you guys and the welcoming that I got from you guys. And we'll talk about some of the adventures we got into after, but I remember showing up at your place with a 2-year-old in my arms.
Yeah.
A very big and contrived mask of everything's fine, everything's okay, you know? But I was like falling apart.
Yeah.
I was deep into my alcoholism back then, and I was learning words from you guys, words like PTSD, TBI.
Yeah.
You were educating me on the fact that I was living a very unhealthy lifestyle with all the garbage that I was eating. But basically, I remember just going there and starting my process and getting to learn what it was like to be an American by you guys. And you're very, unorthodox Americans in a lot of ways.
Yeah, counterculture.
Counterculture in a lot of ways. But in a lot of ways, I've seen both you and Kelly go out of your way to help people and to be of service, not just for just individuals like myself, because you, like, I'm living proof that you guys are, you know, we're lifesavers, but for community activism and going out and helping people that went missing. I mean, you've done a lot of that type of work, where you go out there and train people to be better, better equipped, and actually a few cases where you had to go out and search for people and stuff like that, basically tracking and stuff like that. So
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for their generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the Dead Drop tier. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Your support not only makes this show possible, but also support some of the charities that we run, including the Fighter's Kitchen out of Puerto Escondido, where we're supporting some up-and-coming fighters under the tutelage of Eddie Farrell. Thank you for your support, and again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
Kelly's done a lot of work with grid awareness, like trying to secure our grid from solar flares, EMPs, all that kind of stuff.
50 cals being shot at infrastructures.
Yeah.
Like, I remember learning some of that. Basically, Kelly showed me the realities of what the U.S. was in a lot of ways, because I had this delusion that the U.S. was, I don't know. I'm an immigrant. I've never lived in the U.S. before, so I had this kind of like, oh, everybody's kind of chill here. Everybody's kind of on the same side. No, not really.
Yeah.
I kind of start seeing some of those aspects. And I was going through my immigration process during the 2016 elections.
Yeah.
So it was like, I was an immigrant at kind of the, like one of the hardest times to be an immigrant, I guess.
Yeah.
With all the stuff that was going on. And I was kind of getting pulled into identity politics because of where I'm from and who I am and who I should support, who I shouldn't support. And I'm just an immigrant trying to figure shit out.
Yeah.
But I was learning directly from you guys, you know, what it, you know, what it took, I guess, in a lot of ways. Mm. We had a lot of moments where you basically took me out of existence, you know, not with drugs because, you know, drugs are pretty easy, you know, just get mushrooms and shit like that. I grew up with them.
Yeah.
But you gave me a different type of drug, nature.
Yeah.
Reconnecting.
Yeah.
We went to these hot springs.
Yeah.
Remember that, Dad?
Yeah.
I'll post up some pictures of this later on my Instagram account so you can see it. What are the name? Deep Creek?
Deep Creek Hot Springs. Now everybody's going to go there.
It's fine. They're great, though.
Everybody should go there.
Everybody should go. But it's like, I don't know, you sometimes you look back on events to try and make sense of them.
Yeah.
And I know you, I don't know if you were doing this on purpose or not, or like what was going on there, but I remember just both of us being in a, like a high stress space. Yeah. Like I was basically trying to reinvent myself and you were going through some issues and we're trying to figure things out. And you're like, you know what? Let's just go, let's go to the hot springs.
Yeah.
If you've never been there, it's basically showing up to this giant deep ravine. And all the way at the bottom of this ravine is a very cold-ass river that you have to cross before you get to these warm, rejuvenating, beautiful hot springs that are there.
Yeah.
I remember not being in the best physical condition making my way there. Sleep cycles were non-existent. Nutrition was pretty bad. And somehow I made it all the way down there with you. And like we spent a few days there, disconnected from everything, no cell service.
Yeah,
which and I don't think you know this, but it was the first time that I was without a cell phone or cell service or communication since I was 20.
Yeah,
and
wow,
you fucking unplugged me from the matrix. We spent some fucking amazing time out there.
Just
chilling in these hot springs.
Yeah.
And then on our way up, Dan, we see this rescue helicopter fly overhead.
Yeah.
And I remember if you said it or I said it, like, ah, some poor schmuck probably got stuck down there.
Well, yeah, some kids were doing some flips off the rocks, and we were like, hopefully one of them didn't hit their head. But I think one of us said, this is probably our wives called the local sheriff or because they, you know, thought we were supposed to be back sooner or something.
And that's exactly what had happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We start getting service and ding 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 ding.
Like I think we basically said we made a basic mistake of not being very defined with the time frame that we were going to be.
Well, one wife thought one timeline and the other wife thought the other, you know.
So there was mixed timelines there, and it was a great adventure.
Turned into learning
experience.
our rising fear turned it into an even greater adventure.
Yeah, the amount of shit that we were in. And I remember just already being stressed out, coming out of this amazing transformative hot spring experience.
Yeah.
You were showing me like how to sustain myself in the cold water and then going into the hot water and just going through this great experience with you, learning, you know, about all these fucking things that were around me. And all of a sudden I was cast back into this chaotic environment. We drove in there in this weird back road.
Well, because of all the pressure we were getting from, like, if you're not dead, you're gonna be, you know. So we're like, we got to find a quicker way out of here.
Yeah.
And that led to, you know, just
we were looking at some
worse
maps.
And worse.
We were looking at some maps, and We were in a car that was not optimal for off-road.
It wasn't four-wheel drive.
It was not a four-wheel drive vehicle. And somehow...
We went down something that only an ATV could get out.
Yeah, this canyon road. It looked like a road, but maybe it was like a river. I don't know.
Like some. And I had just been through an off-roading school through the Navy. And
you were trying.
I was using every ounce of it, what I learned.
You were trying. I think that was a moment that I think, I don't know about divinity, but somebody was testing us there, you know?
Well, and a sandstorm was coming in. It was starting to get dark.
The phones were ringing like, the sandstorm is coming.
Yeah.
we went down this ravine that we could not get back up.
Yeah.
It was just not happening.
Yeah.
We're trying all the tricks and there's no way. So I'm on the phone looking at satellite maps of the area, trying to, like, you can go through here and here, but some of these pictures are out of date.
Yeah.
So I'm like.
Well, and some have been sealed off, you know.
So we finally make it to this road that had, like, oh, you can go through here.
Well, there's a gate we had to pick a padlock on.
But to get through it, we had this cow gate, I guess, this cattle gate with a master padlock on there.
Yeah.
And we're both ninjas. I'm like supposed to be like the specific ninja for padlocks. But like, why am I gonna carry a set of lock picks to these hot springs? So like I said, I'm not gonna need those.
Yeah.
And we needed them. Yeah. We needed lock picks at this precise moment.
Yeah.
And like you dug them out of who knows where you
had. I keep them in my wallet.
Yeah.
All the time.
You dug those out and you're like picking this lock.
Yeah.
We made it through that. Then further on, we found this giant just pile of bramble bushes and a boat out there in the middle of nowhere.
A hot tub,
basically all these things blocking our way to get out.
Yeah. And so you had to use, we learned a big lesson because you used your fingers. And
so imagine this fence that has been broken through 1,000 times and rewired and repatched up, this just mess of wire.
Yeah.
And me and Dan standing in front of it. And like asking, like, do you have your Voltaire tool? Do you have yours? How are we gonna do this? And I'm like, with my bare hands, just untangling this fucking wire as you're maneuvering the vehicle closer to see if we can kind of figure this shit out.
Yeah.
Hands bloody. Oh, you're covered in these thorns, spikes. The car's somehow still operable.
We ripped off, you know, undercarriage protection underneath, like all that plastic stuff that they have.
Somehow we fucking make it back on the road after all this shit.
Yeah.
I think a big part of that experience for me in that memory, like it's one of my favorite memories. You know, it's both like a relief that I was, you know, in that place and I got to like experience those hot springs with you. But also coming out and it's weathering this fucking storm with you. You get to learn a lot about people when you go through like experience like that.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Like, who are you
when
it's good and who are you when it's like fucked?
Yeah.
I think what our friendship got really solidified after that because both of us were deep shit after we got back.
Yeah.
But I think one thing I got to just realize about you is one, we were both in a place where egos and like leadership that none of that made sense. We just had to fucking do our parts into getting ourselves out of this fucking situation, which wasn't life threatening. Well, maybe for some of us, I guess, but it was pretty like fucking funny and almost mystical as far as that experience we had. To try and get out of this fucking place.
Yeah.
It kind of showed me a lot about you as a person. And again, I got to see you show some tracking skills firsthand and help you out moving stuff around for your classes, because I was doing training myself, but like I could care less about the shit that I was showing people. I wanted to learn some of the skills and tradecraft that you knew.
Yeah.
And I got to see you like make knives
and vice versa. Like I loved everything I picked up from you. Cause you know, like I've done so much dojo training over the years, and you saying you're not scared of the guy who spent his life in the dojo. You're scared of the guy who's been butchering or cutting sugarcane their whole life, because they know what that blade can do.
Yeah.
They know how to use it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, you told me like, yeah, people do dumb things with knives. And like, I felt, are you attacking me, Dan? Because yeah, I've done dumb shit with knives. It's use them as pry bars, try to fucking chop things up that shouldn't be chopping with them. But my main kind of mindset has always been like, hey, I carry a knife. It's a tool. Like, I pulled out my, you made the first version of the Elvia, and people look at this knife like, it's been through hell. Yeah. It's like, I use it. It's mm-hmm. a collector's item. I use it, you know?
Yeah.
It's something I use constantly for fruit, for boxes. And if somebody gets in the way, well, I have a lot of muscle memory already entwined in
yes. my
mind, right? Yeah. So that's kind of been kind of my philosophy.
Yeah.
With you and some of the training that you provide, like, you are a very high-level tracker. When I say high-level, I mean I've experienced tactical tracking with other instructors. I've experienced tracking on more of the primitive side. But you have both of those things. You have both of those things in kind of your background. And when I go out and I had this, I call them kids because they were younger than me. They were about to go through Buds, I think, or like a.
Yeah.
Remember these guys?
Yeah. Or they were in
they were,
Buds.
They were.
Yeah.
They're go, I mean, both of them were basically fucking muscle suits and lungs. And I remember seeing them, both of them show up to your place and like, hey, I'm going to go over some tracking stuff with them. You want to come? It's like, sure. And you guys basically just jogged to this fucking hill on the other side of the other side of this fucking place that we were at. And I'm like, I don't have a giant, I'm not made of lungs like you guys are. So I just fucking jogged behind you for a bit. But seeing you kind of like slow things down and basically start going into just light or what the light has to do with tracking, just going sideways with a light on tracks. Talking about disturbances going on in front of you to see like if like these birds start fucking flying over there, maybe something's over there maybe.
Yeah.
Keeping yourself safe or having overwatch while you're like all these elements that I had never seen anybody go over. And then subtle things like moisture in the ground, like how old a track is.
Yeah.
That's a part of your story or what you're doing or what you do that is, it's kind of not known that widely, but that's a pretty, like, can you talk a little bit about that type of training that you do for people?
Yeah. So always been interested in it growing up but didn't really get anything solid training wise until I got to the Tom Brown Tracking School. And, you know, a lot of people are doing it for nature observation, but there was a search and rescue or a fugitive tracking or the Apache Scout, like not leaving any sign and being able to track your enemies, you know. That's the stuff I gravitated towards. But it's big for just being able to know where to set your traps and where to go to hunt, you know. So that's what I gravitated towards. And I learned, like, you know how I said Tom Brown is very inspirational. So I rounded out my knowledge with students that had gone through his classes 10, 20, 30 years before me. And they had, you know, like Charles Worsham, just amazing how, because Tom Brown shows you what's possible and you get these notebooks full of micros and macros and all this kind of stuff. And if you put in 10 years, you'll get good at that. And some people can shorten that timeline, of course. I wanted the stuff that I could apply right now while I'm overseas and teach to my brothers and stuff like that. So, you know, they know how to spot the disturbance of where an ID is planted, or, you know how to see that somebody set a booby trap on their vehicle, you know, like, so
the melding of the traditional and the modern application aspect of it, I think it's what you, in my eyes, that's what you've been very strong at. You know, there's a lot of people that have had both, but basically, it's like Kelly said that to me once, like one of the most boring things about you is that you were a SEAL. Like the cool little parts of your story are like before.
Yeah.
Because you went through a shit ton with your family experience and kind of like basically what you put yourself through as far as learning.
Yeah.
So having somebody that has both that lifelong skill set just from being a kid and kind of growing up that way and going to this tracker school and then getting all these people and then actually going off and doing your own hero quest and going to war.
Yeah.
So that's, I think that's what makes you kind of unique as an instructor and the rarity of that. And you make your shit. Like I've seen you just make sandals or just improvise some of your tracking tools with stuff as you're walking, you're just taking things off the trees and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, you know, carrying all your tools up here.
Software.
So that, yeah. I mean,
software versus hardware.
Like if you know how to do it, your fire is right here. Like you, wherever you're at, you can have fire. You don't have to rely on a lighter that could fail on you or get stolen or lost. You know?
Like I think the differences I see is some of the more tactical orientated kind of training out there is very gear orientated.
Yeah.
So off the shelf stuff.
Yeah.
And with you, it's both that, I mean, you tinker with it and you modify it to make it work better, or you can actually create it.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, is it safe to say that for anybody to be a well-rounded survivalist, I think you have to have the ability to create first, right?
Yeah.
Like it's essential.
Yeah.
So make something, and if you get to pick something ready-made by somebody that's way better at it with way better materials,
yeah,
you can make that work.
I can make a stone axe pretty much anywhere given the right kind of rocks, but it's not going to work as well as a steel axe, you know? So yeah, you have the axe, but if you lose it, it's taken, whatever, you know, like
that's a well-rounded prepared individual, the one that could do both.
Yeah.
As far as your survival training that you provide people, like I've seen you teach from high level people to kids.
Yeah.
Because I visited you and you were doing a kids class.
Yeah.
And these kids were, I don't know, I was so jealous of their childhood, I guess, because they were getting something.
I know.
Learned some of this.
And they don't know.
They have no idea.
They don't realize. They like no when idea. I was their age, I would have given a testicle or fingers to get that kind of knowledge. Yeah,
these kids were making rabbit sticks and just, you were showing them how to fling those. They were making, you were showing them how to throw lances and how to make traps.
Slings.
Yeah. It's pretty cool to look at, but also the mentor, elder style of learning where they're not only getting to learn from somebody that knows the skill sets, but has stories around each of these skill sets, because that's something I've noticed about you. You talk a lot about other people being good storytellers and Tom Brown you're a great storyteller. Like I saw that with some of these kids where like, you're like, well, one time I had this experience and this happened. And so these kids are now looking at their rabbit sticks differently. Like, oh shit, this is not only a stick. It's like, it could be a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another great storyteller is Tom Brown's protege, John Young. And he's told me I'm a good storyteller too. But like when I compare myself to him, it's like, you know what I mean?
It's hard to witness yourself.
First time I saw John Young teach a class, on plants. I was like, why am I teaching plants? Yeah. You know, like, yeah. So I absorb a lot of that and, you know, learn how to be better. But
yeah, I mean, walking through any place with you is always a learning experience. Like, you're always pointing shit out that, so I look at things differently, and I have eyes that are trying to train for specific things. Like, you can make a bomb out of that. You can, whatever, right. You know, this yeah, weird, yeah. Horrible shit that I have going on in my head.
Yeah.
But you're like, hey, you can poison somebody with that plant over there. Like, what? Yeah, that plant this is a poison. Like, we did a class in Oakland. Remember that?
Yeah.
And you took students down this just, yeah, we're going to walk through here. And they just, and you were pointing out, like, that plant can kill you. That plant is medicinal. You can live off that plant. You can make rope with that one. That's a pretty good thing to make shelters out of. And people's minds were just being expanded.
Because it was some dirty alleyway or dirty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were just making things that people were gathering around supplies. It's like it was a weird thing. Like, I'm going to take you out of the bushes and I'm going to put you in a city, see if your skills transfer. And they fucking do.
Yeah.
They fucking do. I mean, the city is not, it is a wilderness of a sort. You know, resources are different, but it's kind of the same. Like, I saw you basically just go, it's the same thing. Let me just, what's your priorities when you look at stuff like that? What are you looking for?
So, Tom used to say about John Young that he was really good at creating a map of where natural resources were. So, like, he'd go through an area and he can remember what type of trees are there, you know, for the things he can make from, medicinal, edible, all that kind of stuff. And so I've kind of taken that on, like, just making maps. Because Tom would say, like, when you're going through an area, you're, like, always going, what if? Like, if I had to survive right now, or if I had to hide right now, what do I do? So you're not, like, wasting that time thinking when something goes down kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm doing the same thing. And it's the same, like, with when you get in the vehicle. Like, how does this door unlock or open? Like, and I failed on that in your vehicle. I didn't realize the handles missed. But, like, you're it's a lifestyle, you know. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be paranoia. Like, I know a lot of my learning motivation started as a fear of, like, I got to get this knowledge before it disappears kind of thing, or before something bad happens kind of thing. But eventually, you know, you get over, because fear is going to wear you down and stress you out over time. And it's not a great way to live. You know, if there is no peace, there is no power, is one thing Seneca said, I believe. And so I got to a place where, yes, I'm doing this stuff to be prepared, but I'm doing it because I love it. And love became my motivation, and passing it on, you know, so other people could experience. Because, you know, you're talking about how a lot of the stuff you know is destructive and things like that. And I noticed, like, being a creator, like carpentry and stuff like that, and then being a destroyer, and then getting back into creating, like with making the blades, I know they can do nasty stuff, but they can also create things. Like, I think it does something for your soul.
Yeah.
To have that balance. Being able to do both. Because just destroying all the time, I think
that's why, I don't know, like, whatever you want to call fate or God or whatever. I think when you came into my life, and, like, when we were together, you showed me that. Just the ability of creating things.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's not all about, you know, involuntary demolition and or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I had this moment where, like, again, I constantly speak about this at classes, where you, we were in a movie theater and you made a length of rope out of paper, you know, but you twined it really tight. So, like, piece of tissue, weak. But when you twine it and you, like, braid it, you have this strong piece of toilet paper rope, which is pretty fascinating to see.
Yeah.
And that, I remember, like, seeing that. I was like, that's a superpower of a sort, you know? And it really got me into this aspect of, like, creating.
Yeah.
And it's true. There's a power in this creation aspect of being able to transform something from nothing into something functional.
And I would say that would even transfer into creating competence in other people.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, when I got to see you teach, like, when I knew you online and you know, the stories I heard and stuff like that, like, you know, I didn't truly, you know, understand and believe in who you were until I saw the care that you have for the people you teach. Like, so I think that is a creating type thing.
Yeah.
Too, you know, like.
Yeah. I don't know. It's for me, it's always been like this conflict because I know a lot of the things that I'm known for and that I show people are destructive in nature.
Yeah.
Like, I remember this. Like, I've mentioned this before, like, I've found a lot of wisdom and divine inspiration in bathrooms.
Yeah.
This bathroom graffiti.
Yeah.
A person of love has to be a destroyer. That's the absolute essence of the universe, is something I read in a bathroom wall, and I fucking immediately remembered.
So I was just having a thought that makes a lot of sense, because, like, even with construction, like, you got to tear down what's there before you rebuild something. So if
you're showing somebody how to, you know, be a protector or a responsible man or a woman, if you're showing somebody something of this nature, but they're not willing to see the destructive side of that, because if you're a protector, you know, destruction is on the menu.
Yeah.
And I think I had a very disbalanced mindset when I met you, and I think our time together helped me balance out some of those aspects. But yeah, I didn't realize that about myself. I just viewed myself as this guy that was just like, oh, look, this, I'm known for this, and people are kind of freaked out by it. And like, I enjoy teaching.
Yeah.
But there's aspects of it that do bring up stuff from my past that is kind of like hard.
Yeah. You know?
That's why I don't teach 2 weekends in a row, because it messes me up. But seeing the way that you kind of gone through things, and you've been a great teacher and a great mentor in a lot of ways, as far as like keeping me grounded and keeping me eating healthy and taking care of myself, which has been self-neglect is a big part of some of the issues that I have and had in the past. So you've been kind of very, very instrumental in kind of changing some of those aspects on my end. Before we kind of like end this and go, I just want to thank you, because you have done something for me that I know that I can never truly repay. There's a lot of people that talk about brotherhood, about, you know, tribe. And I know this gets tossed around a lot, and some people have done great harm to both of us utilizing some of these words and ways, you know.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think for me, my earned family is what I like to call these people.
Yeah.
Because I earned them. And that's a different way of thinking about it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't deserve friends. I need to earn them. And somehow I earned you, you know, at some point. And you have shown up for me in ways that nobody has ever shown up for me. And number one is that you saved me and my family at our darkest moment. And I think, as far as my part in your story and as our interactions and you finally being here for this interview and kind of like going on the podcast, and hopefully some people seeing more of you through our social media and through some of the training that we're doing, we're going to try and document some of your training so more people can learn about it. But I just want to put it out there, man, you changed my life and you saved it, and I can never truly completely thank you for that.
Awesome.
I know you're one of those guys that it's hard to take those some of those comments, but it's it's true.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was easy with, you know, the way Kelly is, and, you know, so it, we could it was, bring you into our lives, you know, like, and trust me, I mean, we learned so much from you, and we hope we didn't spoil your daughter too much.
Oh, she is she's a 9-year-old, 80-year-old lady. You know, she's smart, sassy. She has Kelly showed her her ways. Yeah. You know, so she's she knows. You know, she's great.
Yeah, and like you know, I've always sought brotherhood or to be a part of something, and I've learned the hard way that you can get sucked into stuff that aren't true brotherhood. And I would say, if you can count your true brothers on more than one hand, they're not all true brothers.
Quality over quantity.
Yeah. And if you're going for quantity, you're going to give up quality. You know, it's so, yeah, no, I'm proud to have you as a brother, and it's been a two-way street all the way, you know, like.
Yeah, we've been going through some shit. You're a knife maker, you're an instructor, you show people how to survive in all sorts of environments. You're also somebody that's very sought after when it comes to their opinions on some of these things. And so for people that are curious about learning from you, people that are curious about getting one of your knives, it's not easy.
Yeah.
I mean, we're friends, we're brothers, and I struggle.
Yeah.
I don't even ask, dude. I wanted a blood shark, and I had to con one out of somebody. Don't worry about it. I stole one from my brother. So if people want to learn more about you, your knives, like, where can they find you?
So trackerdan.com, it's probably got a lot of historical information from websites in the past. At some point I'll be able to put more time to that and make it more interactive and more current. But I've been doing mainly Instagram and for just putting out tips, techniques, drops. Sometimes there's some Facebook groups that have popped up that I'll do some drops on, but it's been mainly blade shows and that sort of thing.
So if people want one of your knives, their best bet is to basically catch you at a show.
Yeah, because we did open up books a while ago, and just with my Navy schedule, you know, being in the active reserves still.
You're still active. Those people don't know that. You're still in.
Yeah, and then traveling to teach people in their location how to track and their natural resources, you know. And like I, being a man of action, I can't stand on the grinder 8 hours a day, 24/7, you know, like
you have to be messing around with shit.
I got to keep my, you know, while my eyes still function, I got to get out there and track and
awesome
and get in nature and all that. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for everything again.
Vice versa. Yeah. Appreciate it.